is Rogue Talk on 94.3 The Bridge, your hometown voice. And now your host, the Rogue announcer, Jeff Smith.
Hello and welcome to Rogue Talk for Friday, August the 2nd. I'm Evan Gigline sitting in for Jeff today, who will be back next week. We have a great show in store for you today, trying to keep the bar high to the level of Jeff Smith for Rogue Talk. And we're going to do our best to try and accomplish that today. A little bit later in the program, we're going to be talking with Rogue Valley Habitat for Humanity. You maybe know that they've been doing a lot of work with a new building project here in Rogue River. They have already some of those units in and active and going with residents moved in, and they are continuing the project, over $1 million project when all is said and done, and they're going to be talking about that today. They are looking for applicants for their next home, and we're going to be talking about where you can go and apply so that you too can live in a Habitat for Humanity home. A great program that they do. We're going to be talking all about that. And then the last segment of the program, we're going to be talking with Pacific Power. We've been hearing about potential power shutoffs for the summer season to mitigate wildfire dangers and things like that. Of course, looking at the map on Pacific Power's website, looks like Rogue River is going to be impacted quite a bit in the event of a power shutoff. Pretty much the entire Rogue River area is in the zone for a potential power shutoff. So we're going to be talking about the facts there with Pacific Power. That's all coming up on today's episode of Rogue Talk. So be sure to stay tuned for all of that. We love hearing from our listeners. You can send us an email by emailing feedback@943thebridge.com. Feedback@943thebridge.com. Put Rogue Talk in the subject line, and we'll get that email right away. And love to hear what you think about the show, and love to hear about what interests or topics might be helpful to you in future broadcasts of Rogue Talk. Well, one of the main things that everyone's been thinking about already this week and last week is the smoke in the area. Of course, we had that fire up at Canyonville, which is kind of deemed the post-97 fire, and that continues to burn, although I'm happy to say that the air quality in our area has been improved quite a bit. As soon as that smoke rolls in, we're already thinking about the wildfires in the area. Southern Oregon especially seems to get hit every year, every summer, with wildfires in the area, which causes then reduced air quality. And that is a major impact on our area, on our economy, and just the well-being of living in Southern Oregon. You know, a lot of us in living in Southern Oregon like to do things outside. We like to go on the river. We like to go on hikes. We like to do things outside. And smoke, breathing in smoke, does not make that quite so much fun. And in fact, not only does it damper the fun, it can actually be hazardous to health. And so when we see that smoke roll in, I think all of us kind of gave a collective eye roll and said, here we go again. Well, the Canyonville fire is now at 30% containment, and they are releasing some of those evacuations on Ritchie Road. So those, I think, have been reduced to a level one or be ready evacuation level. I think it's funny that we have this level 1, 2, 3, presumably to make it simpler, but we always have to say get ready or go. So I don't know how much time it saves by naming them level 1, 2, or 3, but I guess that's besides the point. So they are getting a handle on the fire and happy to see about that. But really, as it affects us, you know, not to take away from those who are in close proximity to the fire itself, but for those of us within the listening range of this radio station who are concerned about the air quality in Grants Pass is good at an air quality level of 29, which is much better than they were forecasting for today. They were thinking today would be in the moderate level at around 65, but a lot better than they thought it was going to be. So great air out there at this moment. Tomorrow, they're forecasting the air quality to be good as well, at the 50 level. So that's the highest level you can be without going into the moderate scale. So it looks like we're going to have good air quality in our area again tomorrow. So if you have plans on Saturday to get out and hike, or maybe just to mow the lawn, that would be a good time to do so. So great to see the air quality as a level that is safe for us. We're going to go ahead and take our first break at this point. When we get back from the break, we're going to be talking with Denise James and Brandon Toms of Rogue Valley Habitat for Humanity, talking about the ongoing project of Habitat for Humanity here in Rogue River, and that they are taking applications at this point. And the application orientation is Tuesday at Rogue Valley Community Church there on Pine Street at 6:30 on Tuesday. You can learn what it takes to get in, what qualifications there are to be an applicant for a Rogue Valley Habitat for Humanity's home. And that would be a great opportunity for someone who fits the qualifications. I would highly recommend it if you can do it. So we'll be talking with them right after this break. And again, at the end of the show, we'll be talking with Pacific Power to talk about those potential power shutoffs. I'm Evan Gigline in for Jeff Smith. You're listening to Rogue Talk, and we'll be right back right after this.
You're listening to Rogue Talk on 94.3 The Bridge.
With SRN News, I'm Keith Peters in Washington. President Trump says he thinks the confirmation process for his nominee for Director of National Intelligence would have been a long, hard slog. Mr. Trump told reporters Friday before leaving Washington that Texas Congressman John Ratcliffe is an outstanding man and said he was treated unfairly by the press. The president says he'll be reviewing three other candidates this weekend to succeed Dan Coats, who resigned last week. A lawyer for the officer accused of using a chokehold in the death of Eric Garner says his client is disappointed an administrative judge recommended his firing. But the lawyer says he remains cautiously optimistic the officer ultimately won't be dismissed. Attorney Stuart London said Friday that Officer Daniel Pantaleo did nothing wrong and plans to keep fighting for his job. Pantaleo was suspended Friday pending a final decision by Police Commissioner James O'Neill. On Wall Street, the Dow down by 98 points. This is SRN News.
Welcome back to Rogue Talk. I'm Evan Gigline filling in today for Jeff Smith. In a moment, we're going to be talking with Rogue Valley Habitat for Humanity. But first, just want to remind you that we love hearing from our listeners. So send us an email, feedback@943thebridge.com. We'd love to hear what you think about the show. If you have ideas, show topic ideas, love to hear that as well. Just put Rogue Talk right there in the subject line and send us an email, feedback@943thebridge.com. We would love to hear from you. Well, it's an honor for me to have in studio Denise James, who's the executive director of Rogue Valley Habitat for Humanity, and also the director of operation, Brandon Toms. Thank you for both for taking the time to come in, and welcome.
Welcome. Thank you.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Well, I am excited to have you guys back. I know you've been working on this Rogue River project for a while now, and we're looking for another round of residents. So we'll talk about that. But let's talk about Habitat for Humanity in general. I know sometimes people think that Habitat for Humanity is about building a house and just kind of giving the keys of the person, first person that walks by, and now you have a free house. That's not quite what goes on there. Tell us, Denise, what Habitat for Humanity is all about.
Correct. That is correct. That's not really what happens. Families or individuals that apply have to qualify, and there's an income guideline, a requirement. They have to have a need for housing, and they have to be willing to help what we call partner, which means help build the home. They have to have 500 hours of sweat equity. They also have to participate in a lot of homeowner education so that they're prepared to become a homeowner. And what's the third one? They have to have a need, they have to be willing to partner, and they have to have the right income. They have to prove that they can make that payment, because once we're finished building the home, we then sell it to them with a 30-year mortgage that they can afford, and they pay that to us directly. We carry that note. So they're paying it all back to us. It just takes a long time. We don't charge interest, and so the payment is very affordable to them. So we're able to really give them a hand up because of an affordable, stable, decent place to live.
From an operations perspective, does the note at valued at what the home would value at, or is it the cost of building, and are you able to roll that over to other projects?
We have kind of a complicated formula, but we actually sell the home for what the appraised value is. That keeps the neighbors happy also, because that's a selling price. But we break that note into two parts. The first part is what it costs or what they can afford, and the second part is what we call the silent second. It's the difference between the two. So it stays on that note for the life of the mortgage, and if they need to sell sell and move away, then they owe that both of those parts to us. We use those funds each month to roll it into the building program and use it for the next project.
So it seems like, you know, as Habitat for Humanity grows, it can keep doing more and more projects because of these, you know, loan payments coming in and helping more people get into a home who otherwise couldn't do so.
Correct. It is. It's not really enough to sustain the building program right now. We hope to do that at some point. But it also proves that each gift that we receive to help our building program is perpetual, because as it comes back to us, we're going to use it again.
Excellent. Tell us about the learning to be a homeowner. What are some things that are new, surprising, or maybe things you never thought of before in owning a home?
It's taken us a long time to figure that out, that people just don't move into a home and already know things about maintenance. They're used to calling a landlord. And as well as maintenance outside, what does it look like? We try to really impress upon them that that house is always going to be stigmatized as the Habitat home and reflection of us and our organization. So we try to teach them to take care of it outside. They also learn about what does homeowners insurance mean. Many times they don't realize all those components of that, and how to get along with neighbors and what codes are. And those are things that people just don't really think about prior to moving into their home, as well as knowing when to change the filter of the furnace or just different things about maintenance of the home as well.
One thing I was really impressed with that I didn't know before we had you in last time is how you guys deal with funding and donations. If I donate to housing, none of that donation goes to support administrative costs. Could you talk about that?
That's correct. We have to fundraise for each house that we build. We don't receive funding from outside sources like other affiliates in the state, or not much from government funding. The Habitat International Office does not support us financially, so we're always raising funds. And luckily for us, we have our Restore. We have two of them, one in White City and one in Medford, that supports the administration part of it. So that we know that, or we can tell our donors that each dollar that they want to donate to us is all used for boards and nails.
Oh, wow. That's great. Now, Brandon, let me turn to you. Now, Rogue River has been involved in this, or Habitat for Humanity has been involved in this project in Rogue River for some time. How are things going so far?
I think they're going great. We'd, of course, always like for us to be able to cultivate the development faster, because we know that there's a need out there and we want to house these families as quickly as we possibly can. But we have to be realistic about doing what eventually will be a multi-million dollar improvement to the city of Rogue River. And I think I'm happy with the work that we've been able to do with the community's support and the construction volunteers. And I know it's just going to grow as we've made a positive impact and other people are inspired by the change.
Tell us a little bit about the project, what it looks like for those who don't know, what kind of structures exist and which ones are going in.
So Dove Place is a development off of Foothill Boulevard in Rogue River. It was a donated parcel of property by Louise Wall in 2015. And then through some city planning and through some development, we invested about $250,000 in infrastructure to get that ready to house 16 units. The construction and planning requirements for the city of Rogue River, we had to work within. They're a little bit different than what we encounter in other larger municipalities, but we were able to all come to the table and make it work. It will house 16 at this moment. The plan is 16 zero lot line units. Some people may call them duplex. There's a little bit of a difference, but
so the difference is that the unit itself is owned. It's just maybe connected to the neighbor, but the property itself is solely the ownership of the owner. Is that right?
Kind of. So the way that the planning was required in the city of Rogue River is that they are each unit shares the ground. They're kind of a condominium on their two sets. And the only thing they share really is the roof line and the siding. So there's a 6-inch firewall between each of the walls on the inside. So it provides a little bit of satisfaction that they're not 100% wall sharing.
Sure. How large are these units?
They're typically anywhere from 900 to 1,200 square feet because we've really focused on the family need. In Rogue River at this point, it's what's been presented to us as when we do community outreach. And so those are typically a 3-2.
Talk to us about the community outreach. I know one thing that's important to Habitat for Humanity is not that you're, you know, just coming in as some kind of corporate outsiders and plopping in a project, but you actually get involved in the community, wanting it to actually serve the community that it's located in.
Sure. So I think that one of the biggest aspects about getting community involvement for us is that Into the Habitat model is built volunteerism for success. We cannot build and be sustainable of providing these inexpensive homeownership options for people without free sweat equity, without free labor from the community in the form of volunteerism. So the nice thing is we have the plans in place and the ability to teach and train people. And so we can make sure we get it done correct and effectively. But that's the magic to it, is that everybody gets together and everybody supports. And it's not just construction. Like we're supported by individuals from Rogue River on Family Services Committee, which is the committee that helps us select families and then work with them all the way up until they eventually purchase their home. So I know we have a board member that is from Rogue River. So we recognize that we're coming into a community that we've not built in before. And we really wanted to prove ourselves to the community that we're not just here to do it the way we feel best. We want your input and we want you involved because we know that's the key to long-term success.
I'd like to address this concern because I think sometimes people are adverse to the idea of a Habitat for Humanity project coming in. And I think the perception is that, well, it'll be given to maybe low-income families, and low-income housing has kind of a stigma that, well, properties won't be taken care of and it'll drop property values around. I don't know, either one of you wants to address that concern, but is that a misnomer?
I think it is a misnomer. we will never get it 100%. It's just impossible. But we put every stopgap in place to make sure, like Denise mentioned earlier, that we're providing the education that we need. When we take people from a cycle of rental or maybe even a cycle of poverty and put them into an opportunity where they can be responsible for this really catalyst to hopefully a brighter future, it's all in the tools that you give them to be prepared. And I think also to circle back to what you said about community involvement, they see these people are coming together to support their future and their happiness and their family's well-being. And it really solidifies probably different so than just having an affordable place to live, like a rental situation, that people are invested in my success. And I want to reciprocate my appreciation for that investment with how well I do from here on out. Like I said before, does the circle miss the dot sometimes? Yes. But I think we have done a fantastic job making sure that what's going on here is the right thing for the community. We build according to what the municipality has requested of us, and in an ethical and responsible way.
I think statistics also have proven nationwide through Habitat neighborhoods that typically the Habitat homeowners are typically taking better care of their neighborhoods. They have more invested. I mean, they've been out there pounding nails, and mm-hmm. and they also have a relationship with each other. They've gone through a lot of the processes together. They know, for example, they know who they are. They know that we've vetted them, that they're safe people. They also often become neighborhood watch captains and looking out for one another. We've built some other neighborhoods in Medford where the children are just close with one another and are comfortable coming and going in homes, and mothers are watching for them all. And they become usually a much tighter group. And the appearance is usually, very rarely is it a poor looking environment.
When a resident decides to sell, are they free to just list it on the MLS like any other homeowner, or what's the process of selling a home if they choose?
In our Habitat program, yes, they can. We have a formula for that. Of course, like I said, they have to pay that first and that second, and we also have an equity share formula. So the longer they stay in their home, the more equity we're going to share with them. But we really do try to protect that asset that we have, that we've developed, whether it's from our volunteer labor, from our donors that have provided funding to us, that there's no opportunity for flipping homes from Habitat. People can sell if they need to, and we've had a couple that have done that. It's generally due to divorce or they're moving out of the area, but they're never going to get a better deal, and
sure,
they know that.
Well, and as you said, that you're placing residents who are going to be able to pay a mortgage. So, I mean, we talk a lot about the so-called housing crisis in Oregon and Southern Oregon, but these are residents who could probably pay rent if they can pay the mortgage for a Habitat for Humanity home. But the opportunity that is afforded them to be able to now start building equity of their own. What a great hand up it is, as you mentioned.
Exactly. I think that's the value of Habitat is that equity building process.
Yeah. Okay. So where does the Rogue River Project go from here, where we are today?
So we look for additional families. We're preparing on August 6th to begin our search. We need an additional family for a unit that we're currently working on. This opportunity for application is not in our typical application cycle. We're just building really fast and want to make sure we find the new homeowner for one of these units in particular that we're working on. So on August 6th at 6:30 at the Rogue River Community Church, we will be hosting an orientation for people to come and learn about the program, learn about some of the requirements that are associated with the program and qualifications. And then that'll be the day that we begin accepting applications. Applications will be due then back to us by August 30th, so we can hopefully work with the communities, the committee, the Family Services Committee, and get those new families vetted and selected and working on the house we're putting up at the moment.
How long does that process take? If applications due the 30th, what would be the anticipated wait time?
So, again, this is a really big process that has a really big outcome, and it's regulated federally because we are a lender, because we are building houses. So it's not just we come to work the next day and review them and then call you and say you're selected. We want to make sure we find the right person who's prepared that's a good fit. Typically, the process takes about 4 to 8 weeks while we review the income, while we pull and look at their credit situation. We interview the family. We take a look at where they're living now. We really do a full circle vetting process to make sure we're finding just the right people that are currently prepared and available to move into the Habitat experience.
That's great. Before we talk about qualifications, let's talk about requirements. What are the requirements for someone?
So, like Denise mentioned earlier, they must have the need for housing, so be living in something substandard, or be overburdened with rent, maybe overcrowded. The second is they must have an ability to pay. So we are here to serve low to moderate income families, and there is a minimum and a maximum income for the household that's based on the size of the family. There's also some credit requirements about liens and judgments and collections, because it is an asset that we're providing to people. And if there's some past credit problems that have not been handled or rectified, it can affect the house itself. It can attach to the house. And that's just not setting someone up for success walking into that situation from the beginning. So we ask that some of those things be rectified before being approved for the program. And then third, as in a willingness to partner. So needing to be willing to go out and share your story and be in the job site and help our volunteers construct their future, pretty much.
What would that look like? If I was an approved applicant, what should I expect as far as the involvement during the building process and even thereafter?
So it's different for everybody. We have applicants that if you're a two-person household, sometimes the maybe a stay-at-home mom with some little ones, and for liability reasons, we can't have children on the job site. So it's a balancing act that I think we've done a fantastic job with accommodating those life needs, because at the end of the day, they're still living in a low to moderate income or poverty situation that they still have to survive. So sometimes it's easy for us to think, well, Habitat's so exciting, we must just be your whole world. And we've done a really good job of making sure that we accommodate where they're still at now until they can purchase their Habitat home. And so back to your question, we really do a good job of holding ourselves accountable to their availability, whether it be building on a Saturday or helping us taking home flyers and stuffing so we can send out newsletters and finding ways for them to really invest. The ReStore is a great opportunity for a lot of homeowners because it's open 7 days a week. Mm. So if you have some time on a Sunday afternoon after church, people run down for a good 4 hours of afternoon work at the ReStore. So, we're really good about giving opportunities. So, but it's an important aspect, that giving back on that spot equity piece. Yeah, we really want them invested in the program.
Yeah. Is there a requirement for the applicants to be located in a particular place at this time?
There is. And that's a great question. Thank you for prompting with that. Is that because we are Habitat, our affiliate, our service area is Jackson County, and we fundraise in Jackson County, and our volunteers typically are from Jackson County. So in order to qualify for this build, you do have to have an affiliation with Jackson County. We used to require that you live in Jackson County for at least the last 12 months. We've been able to provide some exception so that now you would need to either live or work in Jackson County for the last 12 months. We know that we are wonderful partners bordering here with Josephine County. We have to be respectful that there is an affiliate in Grants Pass doing their own house building for their community. So in return, we do have to require that Jackson County affiliation. And this one is specific to family size. Normally we allow everyone to apply, but we're already in the building process, and this is a 3-bedroom, 2-bath unit. So the minimum family size for this unit is 3 individuals. And it also needs to be able to accommodate your needs. It is a 2-story unit. So if there is a need for a single level home, this might not be the best choice. But the great answer is we're always building all over the county. So if this isn't a good fit, unfortunately, I know how people want to get in and get things rolling, but the right fit will likely come along soon.
Excellent. What about volunteer opportunities? You mentioned a few of them there. If someone listening wanted to be involved in the construction building, what would that look like?
So we offer volunteer orientations every Wednesday at 4:00 at our administrative office on South Pacific Highway. We also recognize that Rogue River is a little bit of a jaunt for people. So we've equipped some of our key volunteers and our staff that's at the job site in Rogue River to be able to support the volunteer orientation process from afar, for outside of the office. So if people call us or send us an email and let us know their intention that they want to get together and they want to join our build team, which they currently build Tuesdays and Fridays from 8 to 2, just let us know, and we'll give you a quick rundown of the things that we ask of you, and then we can communicate that with our leadership at the job site to make sure we're prepared for you and get you on board.
I want to add a little bit to that. I'm going to give a shout out to the Rogue Valley Realtors Association. They are sponsoring one of the houses of the 2 we're building now, and so there's a lot of realtors that are coming in different groups. They've just really pulled together for us in a great sponsorship. But we also have other ways of groups to participate, not only just with the realtors, but we have what we call an Apostles Build program that we use more in Medford, but we've got a lot of church participation. Hope Presbyterian is fabulous at financial support and bringing volunteers as well with your church group. We also, every year in the spring, we do what we call a Women Build campaign, where we just do some training for women and offer some fundraising competitions. But, you know, even though that timing isn't right now for us, we do like to see women come out, and we'll do some special training. We have women on the job site now that we'd love to share and teach. And then we've also got some team building opportunities with businesses that might want to come out as a business day and bring their group. We've had had several groups of banks and insurance companies and title companies that have come out for the day and brought their whole team out. So we have lots of different ways of participation as well, not just an individual call to us.
Now, all training is provided. So if I don't know how to swing a hammer, that would be something that could be taught on site.
Right. And you might not do it the safest way. And we'll show you how we would ask of you to do it the Habitat way. So our biggest thing is safety on the job site. We want to make sure everybody goes home at the end of the day with all the fingers they came with and having a great experience.
And I assume you have a good track record on that so far.
We do. Knock on wood.
No
We're
fingers
doing good.
Left. Okay, good. That sounds like an opportunity for someone, if maybe I was needing to learn some new skills, to learn those specific tasks on the job and be able to give back to the community in the process, that sounds like a win-win.
Or even just educate yourself. If you're a resident of Rogue River and you know that this organization is coming to change your town, I will tell you it's for the good, and I promise. But if you want to come and witness that for yourself, join us on the job site. There's no better way to educate or immerse yourself in what's going on than really just to get out there and be alongside the volunteers that have been here since day one. They're our best testimony, and they're the best way for you to really wrap around what's going on and move beyond those misconceptions or rumors.
Sure. Denise, could you talk about how a Habitat for Humanity project impacts the community and how it's a benefit to the neighborhood that it sits in?
Well, I certainly hope that it is. That's what I've been telling all the officials in Rogue River since we've been here, is I just think, first of all, the neighborhood bonding experience with each other. There's some accountability with the children that are growing up. Everyone pretty much in the neighborhood has been, like I said, vetted through our programs. But because of that interaction of building together, attending the education, but we also do a lot of fun things. We have our wall-raising ceremonies and dedications, and we do Christmas parties and things together. So there's a lot of bonding that happens. So those children that are growing up in that neighborhood have gotten that closeness and that accountability that a lot of kids in poverty don't have. I also believe it is a way to break a cycle of poverty, because the family has more cash flow, not only because our mortgage payment is lower than a rent payment, we also build very green, so their utility bill is much cheaper. So there's a lot of cash savings, which allows the family to purchase other things that are needed. But I also think that the ripple effect within the community is strong. We try to purchase items from local vendors. We try to use professional trades that are in the area, plumbers, electricians. We try to really utilize the community as much as possible and recognize them, so that we're supporting the community not only in bringing some affordable housing, but bringing in some dollars. Like Brandon said, the project's going to be over $1 million project before we're done. And it's a slow project, but for each one, we're spending money here.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's important, too, to also mention that we aren't just handed a job card when we roll into Rogue River, that we have expenses and fees from the municipality itself for permits and SDCs and improvements that also have an impact on the community, that support the infrastructure of what Rogue River is. That's not something that just gets written off the books. It's something that we also have to pay as well.
Yeah.
When the family becomes a homeowner, they become a property taxpayer. So I haven't done the math, but at 16 homes, paying some property tax will make a large impact as well. And even though that may go to Jackson County, there's still some of those funds that come back into local schools, different bond levies that might be passed. So it's going to come back as well.
There's a lot of then benefit to the community for this development to come in a lot of ways. And you mentioned before that someone whose place might not be a resident of Rogue River proper, but somewhere else in Jackson County. So you have at least another family into the community once their place. That's good. Well, let's go over the meeting again coming up. It's next Tuesday then on the 6th at 6:30 at Rogue Valley Community Church, which is located at 623 Pine Street. And this is an opportunity for anyone who would like to put an application for to be placed in housing. And and to go over the requirements and qualifications. And if anyone's interested, they should definitely go to that, right?
Exactly.
We'd love to see them. And if they read the requirements and the qualifications and there's something that they have a question on, I think it's important to know that while we may not be able to wipe that requirement off the map, or we may not be able to approve their situation at the moment, to me, it's worth my time in a conversation.
Yeah.
So if there's something on there, that don't just discount yourself and don't count yourself out. If you know you don't live or work in Jackson County, then I probably don't have a solution for you. But if your credit challenges, your concern may be an impact, or you're not quite understanding how to calculate your gross annual income or what may be included in that, please don't just count yourself out. I want you to make sure you had an opportunity to really be vetted for this opportunity.
Absolutely. I mean, it's going to take maybe an hour of my time, and if there's even a possibility that one of these things could work for me in the future, that hour is probably going to be a huge change in my life just because of the opportunity it affords me. So, Brandon, Denise, thank you so much for coming in. Rogue Valley Habitat for Humanity. And keep up the good work. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
We appreciate it.
Well, one more segment of Rogue Talk coming at you right after this. Stay tuned through the break, because when we get back, we're going to be talking with Christina Kruger. She's the Regional Business Manager for Pacific Power. And we're going to be talking about the potential. We've been hearing about the news. We've been hearing about it on TV, the potential power shutoffs to mitigate wildfire risk. And Rogue River is affected. We're in one of the areas that would be affected potentially by a power shutoff if the certain conditions are right. We're going to find out what those conditions are and what you should do to get ready for a potential power shutoff. We'll get it right from Pacific Power here on Rogue Talk on 94.3 The Bridge. Evan Gigline in for Jeff Smith. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Don't go away.
You're listening to Rogue Talk on 94.3 The Bridge.
With SRN News, I'm Keith Peters in Washington. President Trump says he thinks the confirmation process for his nominee for Director of National Intelligence would have been a long, hard slog. Mr. Trump told reporters Friday before leaving Washington that John Ratcliffe is an outstanding man and said he was treated unfairly by the press. The president says he will be reviewing three other candidates this weekend to succeed Dan Coats, who resigned last week. Ratcliffe, a Republican congressman from Texas, had been criticized in media such as The Washington Post and New York Times for exaggerating elements of his resume and for a lack of experience in the field of intelligence. The director of national intelligence oversees more than 15 U.S. intelligence agencies. Another down day on Wall Street as the Dow plunged 98 points to close at 26,045. The Nasdaq dropped 107. More details at srnnews.com.
Something you've seen in the news, that Pacific Power has announced certain zones that they may shut off in case wildfire danger exists. Thanks for staying through to this edition of Rogue Talk. I'm Evan Gigline, sitting in for Jeff Smith. Great to have you with us today. Well, it happened down in California. PG&E has filed bankruptcy and being blamed for the cause of the fire that hit Paradise, California, where we saw loss of life, loss of massive property, and it wiped out the entire town. And to what extent was the power company liable for that? Well, Pacific Power has taken some steps to be more proactive in this approach and has announced certain zones that could be shut off if those circumstances arise. And to help answer some of the questions and to discuss what this might be is Christina Kruger. She's the regional business manager for Southern Oregon of Pacific Power, and she joins us here in studio. Christina, thank you for taking the time to come in.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So I think what most people just know from seeing things in the headlines and hearing the buzz around town is that Pacific Power might potentially shut off power to prevent wildfire risk.
Sure.
How is that as a relation to the facts?
Sure. So I think we're all aware that the wildfires have been increasing with frequency and intensity in our region. And taking a look at what's been happening in other areas, we can't help but acknowledge that there is room for possible improvement and taking a look at how we operate within the areas that we serve and what we can do to be proactive about keeping our communities safe. And so what that looks like is a broader wildfire management mitigation plan that we've adopted, which includes several factors, but one of which, what we believe is a minor component, is the public safety power shutoff aspect of it. If we're to go deeper, what we're looking at is increased vegetation management. So we've absolutely bolstered that. I think a lot of people are seeing that out in the community now. We're also doing some hardening of our system. We've identified areas that we call high fire consequence areas. And then within those areas, there's some communities where we believe, you know, there's a greater risk of potential wildfire to happen should there be, you know, debris or something that comes into contact with our lines. And so those are the areas that we may potentially shut off the energy. But if we do so, we would be providing pretty ample notification to our customers, and we would be working in collaboration with emergency services to make sure that they're prepared.
Okay, so a power shutoff is certainly inconvenient for us wanting to watch Netflix, but there's also pretty serious ramifications of that as well. I think of people who rely upon medical equipment right. and things like this. What should citizens be prepared for
sure.
who are relying upon energy for those very important pieces of equipment?
Right. There's actually a term that we've been kind of using with our emergency services managers, which has really been never waste a crisis. Right. And so what that means is that I think the concern around potentially not having energy, I think, is a little bit scary for some people. And I think it raises their level of awareness around, you know, what can they do to be prepared? And so those are the conversations that are actually happening now, to your point, which is, you know, what do you have on hand? Should there be an emergency? You know, who are you reliant upon? What are the local resources available to you to make sure that you're connected? And there's an extra pair of eyes looking out for you. So some of those things entail reaching out to us, making sure that we list you as medically dependent on energy if you are. So that's something that's really important. We also want to recommend that you sign up for Citizens Alert. And then in addition to that, take a look at our website, because we have a lot of information there now. It's become kind of a clearinghouse for emergency preparedness information, anything from generator safety to, how to remove waste if there's no energy at your home.
So if I'm in a household where it does rely upon medical equipment, in order to be prepared, mm-hmm. is alerting Pacific Power enough, or should I be getting a generator, or what should I do be prepared?
It's really going to be up to the individual. I think a lot of different people have different plans, right? So maybe getting a generator isn't going to be cost effective for everybody, but having some kind of sense around, you know, how can I collaborate with my neighbors? Am I on all the lists so that there's another pair of eyes looking out for me? The disaster registry is another one that's really good for people that maybe have some physical challenges for that aren't maybe able-bodied and aren't able to get themselves out of a hazardous situation. But to your point, we want to make sure that you're added to the list. It's not enough. You always want to make sure that you have situational awareness. And then I guess I should add that we are going to be establishing resource centers for our communities that may be impacted. So let's say that you're going to experience an outage, or we're forecasting there may be an outage in your area. We'll be setting up a cooling center, essentially, which will have things like air-conditioned units. We'll have emergency responders on staff. We will have water and things to that effect to hopefully help provide some comfort for some folks that might not have anywhere else to go.
I know listeners could probably go online and look at a map to see if they're in one of these zones, but for those listening, our listener range is mostly in the immediate area around Rogue River, going maybe as far as, Central Point to one side and Grants Pass the other.
Right.
How could you summarize the areas affected by a potential shutoff?
Sure. When we're looking at Southern Oregon, Jackson and Josephine County are certainly in the high fire consequence zone. But then within those zones, we've identified 9 areas that are really kind of the potential public safety power shutoff zones. And those are the maps that are all listed on our website. We have about 60 maps. So bear with us, but we tried to be as transparent as possible when it came to sharing that information. So those zones would be areas such as, you know, some parts of Cave Junction, Illinois Valley, Selma, Shady Cove, Rogue River, as well as down by the Monument area in Jackson County. Another thing that people should know is that while those are their maps right now, and we consider all of those areas where people should be prepared, we're also taking a look at what can we do to the systems within those public safety power shutoff zones, right? Those deep pre-designated zones. What can we do within those zones to make sure that we're more nimble and that we impact the least amount of people possible with the shutoff? So that entails putting in added equipment, hardening the system, fireproofing, and things like that. So you'll see those areas kind of shrink over time.
Okay. What circumstances would be present that would motivate Pacific Power to make the decision to do a shutoff?
Sure. There are several thresholds. I think they wouldn't be a surprise to most people. So it's going to be, history of drought. So drought index, as well as relative humidity, as well as some wind thresholds. And so there's a combination of about three items that kind of need to be forecasted to take place in those areas. And then at that point, we would start to kind of notify folks that there may be potential for that to happen. We did, fortunately, when we look at data, we have the opportunity to kind of go back in time to see, using those thresholds, what would have been the impacts in the region. And we found that over the last 8 years, one of these actions, the power shutoff actions, would only have taken place once for a period of 1 hour, and that would have been in the Monument Valley area.
Okay. Is this something that is brand new to Pacific Power, or is this maybe in some way a reaction to what happened with PG&E in California, the Paradise Fire, that maybe lessons learned in that instance being implemented with Pacific Power?
There are a lot of lessons learned about what happened in California, and loss of life is never something that you want to have anything to do with, right? You don't want to be a part of that. So we certainly have learned a lot. The public safety power shutoff aspect is kind of becoming a best practice amongst utilities, particularly on the West Coast. We are very much more proactive than a lot of our neighboring utilities in the state because it isn't mandated, but we feel that kind of getting a jump start, implementing things that we know can be done that can kind of help to mitigate some risk in a proactive way is going to probably be better for our communities than sitting back and waiting for someone that maybe doesn't understand the system to tell us what to do.
Mm-hmm.
So you're right. Yeah, it did influence our decision. And frankly, I think we'll all be better off for it. Is it entirely new? We have... No, it isn't. I mean, we have de-energized before. We do de-energize actually during events, so wildfire events, with our, in partnership with ODF if they ask us to. Or if there's some condition that, deems it to be safer for the public for us to turn off the energy, for example, something happening with another system. But with regards to actually doing it when there isn't something going on, like it might look like a bluebird day to you and me, but there are some other conditions happening that would deem it necessary. So that's a little bit new.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say that's new.
So if Pacific Power is sort of more proactive or on the leading edge of looking at these things, have they been able to lean on other utilities to find models or examples of this, or are they trying to figure it out as they go?
Oh, no. We've been leaning into other utilities that have shown best practice, specifically down in San Diego. They're very engaged. They've been practicing some of these things, and we've tried to take the best of what we've seen through their practices and then kind of expand beyond that. So, we're pretty pleased with what we're seeing so far.
I know you're pretty involved on the level of government and working with local jurisdictions. How have local jurisdictions been able to assist in this whole effort?
They've been pretty phenomenal. So, specifically pointing to emergency services managers, I mean, that is their core mission, is to keep the public safe. And so at first, I can tell you that it wasn't easy to communicate that we were adding something to, the many lists of things that they kind of oversee and take a look at, especially in the, in the beginning, early beginning of wildfire season. I mean, we're kind of a traumatized community when it comes to wildfire, but they have been phenomenal at just kind of poking at our plan and giving us feedback and identifying blind spots and asking all the hard questions and, kind of testing that trust as it, and what we've found through that process is that we've identified room for improvement in all kinds of areas around, you know, how as a community we function and how we work together and how prepared we are, right, or not prepared. So it's been pretty great. In addition to that, obviously, we've had a lot of engagement and interest by local commissioners and city managers and what have you. We also have FireWise groups that have been very engaged, and I've been personally going out and presenting to all those groups. I have a meeting coming up in Merlin and Cave Junction, actually, where I'll be going before the council's there. So everyone is asking questions. Everyone wants to know, you know, what are you doing? And I guess I neglected to kind of mention earlier, we're going to be installing additional weather stations as well, which provides data for the ODF group as well as some others. And so people also want to know, well, how many weather stations are you putting in my community and what does that look like and do I have access to that? So those are ongoing conversations that are pretty neat.
Yeah, absolutely. What's been the response from the public? I mean, when you talk about power shutoffs and degenerizing, it's not really something that people go, oh, great idea. However, I think people also understand that there's a public safety issue here, too. So what reactions are you getting from the general public?
I would say that initially people are afraid, you know, just because it seems like, you know, I'm introducing or we are introducing something new that maybe could potentially make them uncomfortable. And I think there's also that maybe sudden awareness of how dependent on energy we are, you know, just in general. So I think there's a bit of that. But then once you start to kind of walk people through it and just kind of explain to them that this is a last resort, we would only do it if we truly believe it's going to mitigate some really terrible, harmful risk. And that it's truly not our intention and that there's a lot of other work happening up front of that to avoid ever having to do that. People start to really kind of understand that, okay, thank you for telling me. Thank you for answering my questions. And, you know, it's a little scary, but that's the new world we're living in right now.
I mean, I have to look at this as an outsider and kind of look at this as this is probably a uphill battle for Pacific Power from a PR perspective.
Sure.
Because Pacific Power, just within the last year, is dealing with some resistance with smart meter installation, and now we're, you know, dealing with this. So I'm sure that keeps your job very busy. But it's a communication education aspect of Pacific Power as well.
Yeah. So maybe I'm a little strange, but I see this as a great opportunity.
Okay.
You know, it can be really uncomfortable, but frankly, we're in the era of customer choice. I say this all the time. And what that means is that this is a time where we really need to learn how to pivot and adjust and be creative. And with some of these things, you know, they impact every single one of our customers. And, you know, so we need to be as transparent as possible. So, you know, given the kind of nature and the culture in our region, that takes almost like a grassroots type of outreach, you know, where you need to get out into the communities because we're very rural and give people that time and space to be able to ask you those questions face to face, right? So it's been challenging in many ways because I'm only one person kind of doing and taking the charge in that role down here. But at the same time, it's a great honor because it gives me an opportunity to meet people that I might not otherwise meet, to collect feedback and see things from a perspective that I might not have had on my own in a silo. And frankly, I think it makes it better.
If you work in other parts of the state, how does Southern Oregon different than other parts of the state that you work with?
Sure. So Southern Oregon is obviously, given just the terrain, you know, and the climate down here, we are an area that's at greater risk. We know that. We live, recreate, work here. We're part of the community too. So it feels a little bit more extreme down here just because of the fact that, you know, it's the flip side of the blessing of living here, right? The risk. But in other areas, you know, we have the plan that's going to be enacted up near the Hood River area. So they're having a really hard time because they look around and, you know, it's a pretty windy spot. You know, it's known for their wind, their quality wind, as it were. And so they, you know, there's some fear there where people think, well, is this going to be a constant thing? And so it's just trying to provide that next level of assurance. I've noticed that in Southern Oregon, our, you know, our communities are just a bit more resilient. We're a little bit more understanding. I think we have a little bit more of a symbiotic relationship with nature down here. And so, at the same time, like, that gives you a whole other kind of respect for nature and understanding that we can't control it all,
right?
And nor do we want to. But I don't know. It's been pretty good.
Yeah. We've been talking a lot about, you know, possibly doing power shutoffs. Mm-hmm. You mentioned a few things, but what are some other aspects of this wildfire mitigation that Pacific Power is engaged in?
Yeah, so just to kind of recap a little bit and then maybe expand, you know, we're retooling our employees. We're making sure that they are definitely a part of the process even more so than they were before, right? So making sure that they're more engaged in situational awareness. Things like if we have a project coming up, for example, this happened last week, our general foreman went out and basically walked the whole line, walked the system to kind of say, okay, is it going to be safe to do this construction here and now? So that's really big. Making sure that they have added tools on their rigs is also incredibly important. Mm-hmm. And then expanding our vegetation management, you know, getting out there and maybe something that was on an annual or biannual cycle, you know, compressing that cycle and doing it more frequently, flying the lines even more, going in and adding relays, things that will allow us to switch energy from one circuit to another so that we can maybe isolate an area and keep it safer. Fireproofing our system, expanding our communications online, direct outreach letters to customers, holding open houses. The list kind of goes on.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, so a lot of that, to be honest, sounds like it would be very costly for Pacific Power. Mm. Are those costs being offset by grants or government aid, or yeah, is that going to be supplemented by raising costs for the customer?
Yeah, so we haven't actually taken a look at how much it's going to cost because we're just kind of going through it, right? And we're doing it because it's right thing. If there was going to be a rate recovery around it, that would happen maybe years into the future because it just hasn't been quantified. I can tell you that it's been incredibly important for us to keep our rates flat. In fact, we had a rate pledge and we've kept them flat for the last 3 years because of the communities that we serve. We serve primarily rural Oregon. Those are economically constrained areas, and we see that, we honor that and respect that. And so our goal is to not, you know, just shift a bunch of costs onto our customers. But if some of the costs are shifted, it would be something that would happen, you know, it'd be absorbed by all ratepayers, not just local.
Okay. From a perspective of a utility company, is there anything that the individual customer or homeowner can do to mitigate risk?
Well, I think you definitely want to make sure you're informed and just understand, you know, what defendable space is about. I think that's incredibly important. I can tell you, I personally have to do some work on that at my house. Mm-hmm. But make sure that, you know, you're prepared, you know, you have a plan. Make sure you're on those lists. If you need to get on the disaster recovery list, registry list, rather, make sure you're on that if you have some constraints. Also, sign up for, you know, even follow your emergency services group, you know, the emergency management group out of Jackson and Josephine County. They're fantastic. And we're frankly going to be working with them more and more when it comes to local situational awareness and giving them information so that they can distribute that out, because they're really a great resource for us, us being the community. So I would say, you know, use all the outlets, recognize that the information is available, and if you have questions, call and ask, because, you know, the last thing we want is for someone to sit back and not have an answer and then maybe have added stress in their life when it's not needed.
Sure. Well, Christina Krueger, she's the regional business manager for Pacific Power. You've been very generous with your time. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Well, that's going to do it for this edition of Rogue Talk. Again, Evan Gigline filling in for Jeff Smith today. We do want to hear from our listeners. That email address again is feedback@943thebridge.com. feedback@943thebridge.com. Rogue Talk also has a Facebook page. Look us up and join our Facebook page as well. Send Jeff a message through that. Also, again, in case you missed it, the Rogue Valley orientation for applicants. They are taking applications for their newest build here in Rogue River. The orientation is Tuesday, August the 6th. That's next Tuesday at Rogue Valley Community Church, which is over there on Pine Street. The 6th at 6:30. So be sure to show up if you at all think that might be something that fits you. Also, if you want to find more about the power shutoffs, visit Pacific Power's website, which which is pacificpower.net, pacificpower.net, and look at the map and see if your home will be affected by a potential power shutoff. That's it for us. I'm Evan Gigline for Jeff Smith on Rogue Talk. Thanks for listening to this edition on 94.3 The Bridge.
You've been listening to Rogue Talk on 94.3 The Bridge. Listen to Rogue Talk with Jeff Smith Fridays at 3 p.m. right here on Rogue River's Hometown Voice. 94.3 The Bridge. Or on demand at 943thebridge.com.